This is lesson number 27 in our theology course. And what I want to consider in this lesson is the church's constitution and bylaws. Now, obviously, you realize that for the last three lessons, we've moved into an area of administration. I think I pointed that out a couple of lessons ago. We're not dealing here with what the Bible specifically says concerning the church, but we're dealing with some practical applications that we believe are extensions of Bible principle. I want to read two verses of Scripture to introduce this lesson. One of them is 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 40, where Paul says, "Let all things be done decently and in order." And then in the book of 2 Thessalonians chapter number 2 and verse 15, he says, "Therefore, brethren, stand fast and hold the traditions which ye have been taught, whether by word or by epistle." Now, notice in these passages, he talks about holding traditions. He talks about doing things decently and in order. These verses address themselves to order and probably best describe the reason for the adoption of the Constitution and bylaws within a church. Once again, may I emphasize that no church in the process of adopting constitution and bylaws plans or expects to go around, to avoid, to violate, or to circumvent the Scripture. But the idea is to summarize what they believe in a scriptural order and to cement it in agreement so as to prevent the violation of it or vacillation from it to every wind of doctrine that someone may be enchanted with in the future. And, beloved, we live in a day and time when this is very, very important. I mentioned in a previous lesson that I had heard preachers say they didn't believe in constitution and bylaws. Some years ago I was holding a meeting for a church, and the pastor asked me if we had constitution and bylaws. I answered yes, and he said, "Man, we don't." He said, "Anytime if a church can't follow the Bible, I just don't want anything to do with it. Our church doesn't have constitution and bylaws, never will have." Well, of course, I didn't ask him to have them. I wasn't the one who brought the subject up in the first place, and I didn't pursue it any further. I not only didn't want to argue with him about it, I didn't feel that he was competent of a intelligent argument in that particular area at the time. What I did know about the situation was this, that this was the only church that he had ever pastored. There had not been that much stabilization of the church doctrinally under his leadership. Preceding his leadership, they had had preachers in the church there, in that very church, that had been everything short of being absolute holy rollers. And some of the foolishness and semi-heresy that had been preached there before his arrival was absolutely unbelievable. Now, constitution bylaws might not have prevented all of that, but had they have been properly understood and applied, they would definitely have prevented it. Now, once again, the constitution bylaws are basically an attempt to summarize what we believe to be scriptural order. It's not dealing with the articles of faith. The articles of faith are what we believe. Constitution bylaws deal with what we believe to be scriptural order in conduct. And to cement that in such a way so as to prevent the constant movement back and forth by the church and the following of leaders which may go from one direction to another. Now, the first thing I want us to do is to define the terms. We say constitution and bylaws. And I think sometimes people may wonder, is that all one word? Or is it all one term? Or what are we talking about when we talk about constitution and bylaws? Well, by the word constitution, when applied to this subject, we simply mean the defining of the church, its identity, its doctrine, its component parts, such as members, officers, committees, subordinate organizations, and so forth. In other words, what can be defined as being a part of the church? Can we say that the softball team that is organized down the street by some member of the church is as much a part of the church as the mission effort or as the visitation program, and that it has the same rights to the use of church property, or that the church is just as incumbent to support it in its activity as they are the visitation program? And I think most of us would say, well, no, we can't say that. Well, that's what the Constitution is to define. What is the church? What is the work of the church? What comes under the canopy of the church as surveillance and obligation? That's what the Constitution is all about. Now, the bylaws, on the other hand, mean the regulations that outline the duties and limitations of the offices and functions that are outlined in the Constitution. In other words, the Constitution tells us what makes up the church, what falls under that protective canopy, and the bylaws tell us what they may or may not do within that function. That's the basic idea of these. So we see the definition of Constitution and bylaws. I want to move on then to the details of the Constitution, and then thirdly, to the details of the bylaws. Now, I mentioned earlier that in this mailing of lessons, you have a copy of the Constitution Bylaws of Bethel Baptist Church, and it's a little booklet called the Church Members Handbook, and it's 32 pages long. They're short pages; it's not difficult to read. And in that is contained the Church Covenant, the Articles of Faith, which, as I told you, is a sense of the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. And then the Constitution and Bylaws of the Church. Now, I'm looking on page 18 of this as we have it printed. And the heading here says Constitution and Bylaws of Bethel Baptist Church, Lawton, Oklahoma. So we understand that this is something that's been passed by the Church and approved as it is stated here. And the first thing that's stated under this is the Bethel Baptist Church of Lawton, Oklahoma is a nonprofit charitable church corporation without capital stock incorporated under the laws of the state of Oklahoma. Now, this is indeed the way our church is set up. The next point is property rights. And this says the members of this church have no property rights in the assets of the church, and upon the termination of their membership by any means, they shall be entitled to no interest in the assets and property of the church. In the event of the termination and dissolution of the corporation, the assets and property of the church shall be distributed according to the vote of the majority of the members of the Bethel Baptist Church of Lawton, Oklahoma. Now, what's this for? Well, if there was not something of this sort involved in it, it would be very conceivable that a couple of men, let's say that I died, and somebody decided, well, the best thing to do here is to do the best we can with this property. So a couple of men could conceivably, I trust we wouldn't have anybody in church that would do that, but could conceivably put their heads together over a period of time, run all of the other members of the church off, they being the only remaining members then, could sell the property as they please, pocket the money, and go their merry ways and not have violated any law in the world. Due to the fact that our legislators essentially do not make laws concerning churches and religion, and I'm glad they don't, and I hope they don't get all carried away in changing that, but due to that fact, there's little protection against that sort of thing. So the church sets up a statement that indicates that the members of the church do not have those property rights, that the church must act as a whole in that respect. Then the second thing here is the first article of the Constitution. It is the name of the organization shall be Bethel Baptist Church. That's so that we can establish it. Someone can't come along and change the name on the sign every couple of years, as they may feel led to do, and thus do away with or endanger the safety of any property that we may own legally, bonds that we may have issued, though we don't have any at the present time, or other obligations that we may have. Actually, you know, it would not be impossible just to change the name of a church and for charlatans to beat all of the bills that the church had rightly and justly incurred. And so this has to be established. The name of the church is Bethel Baptist Church. The second article is the church covenant, which has been printed in the first of the book, and it shows that we as a church are covenanted together by that. The third article is doctrine. We accept the scriptures as our authority in matters of faith and practice, and adopt the New Hampshire Confession of Faith as our interpretation of Bible doctrine. That, of course, has already been seen over there. Fourthly, membership. Now, this is one of the areas that's very important, and it's important that we know what constitutes this membership. Not only that we have something that definitely constitutes membership, but that we know what constitutes it, and that is put down in some sort of fashion, so that if, God forbid, the church ever had to go into any kind of litigation, that something has been stated and agreed to on paper that would be then legally binding. And certainly this would be. There's no question. If you took the minutes of the church, the time that this was passed, and all of these things, you'd find that this would be legally binding in any court in the land. If justice were followed, the laws of the land were followed, this is a legally binding contract, so as to speak. So it talks about membership, and it says any person may be received by baptism on the profession, upon professing faith in the Lord Jesus Christ. They may be received by their Christian experience, providing they've been baptized according to the doctrines of this church. Thirdly, persons may be received into the membership of the church by letter of recommendation from sister churches of like faith and order. Fourthly, membership in the church may be dissolved by letter of dismissal to sister Baptist churches or by death. However, any member whose conduct is such that it brings reproach against the cause of Christ, the church, or its offices may be disciplined the scriptural way by withdrawing fellowship. Such action will be governed by the scriptural steps and will be in effect until such party or parties makes restitution and adjustment. Now, the fact of the membership here is not a mere statement of something to make operation easy. It's very important. Let me give you an illustration. Some years ago, a preacher friend of mine and I were driving through this city, and on a certain street corner, there is a church, and they had a sign. At the bottom of their sign was written these words, "Salvation makes you a member." And this preacher friend of mine jokingly said, "You know, that's a pretty good-looking piece of property. And your church is bigger than their church. You ought to take your folks over there Wednesday night and declare a business meeting and appropriate that property for yourself and just throw them out. If salvation makes you a member, you could outvote them." And you see, of course, he was simply joking, but you can see the logic behind it. In all reality, if there's nothing to declare what constitutes membership, then there is nothing to protect against the influx of anybody in large numbers or any kind of people, conceivably the Hare Krishnas or the Jehovah's Witnesses or anyone else like that, could come in and take away the property. Now, I realize that you might say, well, God is our protector, and God protects us from things of that sort, and I believe God does protect fools and babies. We're not supposed to be either one. I believe we're supposed to do things decently and in order, so there ought to be something that declares what our manner of membership is. Now, you take any of these churches that don't have constitution and bylaws, they do have some kind of set policies as to the way that they receive members. But what declares that that's right? What declares that that's acceptable? You say the Bible does. Well, that's a matter of interpretation of the Bible. Who declares that that church has accepted that interpretation? And so you have no nail. There's nothing that's a given point of reference there. So I think it's good that something of this sort be put out. The fifth article is the dealing with the officers of the church. And it says, first of all, that there should be a pastor. The pastor shall be called by 2/3 majority vote of the members present at a meeting called for the purpose and announced in the church services the Sunday previous. He shall serve for an indefinite period of time, not to be elected annually as the other officer of the church, since this is the scriptural way. And we don't go into all the reasons why we believe this is scriptural. But the fact is that there are some churches that call the pastor every year. He, therefore, is subjected to a situation of, you might say, a popularity thing. You notice at the present time how that perhaps the most, the most strenuous pressure that's placed on our president at the present time is to be sure that what he does is politically acceptable. You'll find the congressmen and the senators of our nation so frequently for the last 2 years of their stay in the White or in the office, they'll be absolutely shackled in everything that they do by the fact that they're going to have to run for office again. They're not able to act conscientiously in many cases. In fact, in many cases, they don't act at all because any action that they take may be offensive to some constituent, and they're so interested in being sure that their position is secure that they have no liberty in doing what they're supposed to do. Now, I'm not saying, and I hope, that a preacher would not succumb to that kind of pressure, but we are human. And I don't believe that a pastor ought to be in that sort of a position. The bylaws of the church keep him from being subjected to that. It goes on to say, a pastor shall be dismissed only when he fails to perform his duties or lives in an ungodly manner or practices that which does not become a Christian minister. When dismissal of a pastor becomes necessary, it shall be done decently, openly, and after the following order. And it goes and it gives three different manners and three different things that must be done. He has to be admonished with these grievances. If he will not heed this admonition and the thing cannot be resolved, a special business meeting is called before the membership body of the church for the stated purpose of considering dismissal of the pastor. This meeting shall be announced at least one Sunday prior to its occurrence. The pastor shall in no wise hinder the calling or publicizing of this meeting. In other words, this protects the pastor from unscrupulous people in the church calling a meeting quietly or in a corner and dismissing him without knowing why. On the other hand, it protects the church from the pastor blocking a business meeting that might be to his disadvantage. It's for the purpose of protecting both. The third thing that says, in the meeting, the charges shall be specifically declared and shall be established by two or more witnesses, according to 1 Timothy 5:19. The pastor then shall, at his option, be given opportunity to answer the charges against them. If the problem cannot be solved, a motion should be then made to declare the pulpit vacant. The motion must be seconded and carried by a 2/3 majority. In other words, it's not something where you could just run in a few disgruntles on a Wednesday night without notice and do something like this, but it has to be carried in such a way that the voice of the church is clearly heard. Anyone who has been a member for as long as 6 months but who has not been active for 6 months preceding the meeting shall not be eligible to vote in such a meeting. That too keeps you from bringing in a few disgruntles or people that have not been inactive. You know, I have not been active. I've known of churches where a few of the people, one or two of the people, got angry at the preacher because he got in their sin pile with his preaching, and they went out and gathered up people who had not been in church, much less active in the church, for 5 or 6 or 7 years, brought them in, had a business meeting, and threw that guy out on his ear for doing exactly what he should have been doing. And a good set of bylaws would prevent that from happening. I do not say a set of bylaws, because there are some bylaws that wouldn't do anything. In fact, there are some that might even allow that. But a good set would do that. Then it goes on to say, in case of the death, resignation, or dismissal of a pastor, a pulpit committee shall be selected by the church to search out possible candidates for the position. In other words, if the pastor dies, what happens? Does his wife become the pastor? Does his oldest boy become the pastor? Does whoever is in the church who has the most clout become the pastor? What do they do? Is there any format to follow at a time of that sort? Yes, that's what the Constitution lays before us, you see, showing us exactly what we need to do in this particular area. And then, of course, it gives us the second section with the deacons or committeemen in the church, and it talks about what their jobs are, what their authority is, which in reality is not any authority at all. It's not an office of authority. It's an office of service. They really have no authority, but it tells that these men are to be appointed over particular jobs, as Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 3 indicates, and that these men are to be faithful in those jobs, and it tells what their qualifications are. And then, of course, states here that there's a sense in which all officers of the church serve in the capacity of a deacon or a servant in some way, and therefore each officer of the church should strive to conduct themselves according to the standards of 1 Timothy 3, 8 through 13. Then it goes on to give us the other officers or offices in the church. In other words, can we just, at our option, appoint a board of directors that takes over everything in the church and runs it as they please? No. Our Constitution says there shall be a board of as many as 5 trustees, a board of finance consisting of the treasurer and the financial secretary and the board of trustees, a clerk, a financial secretary, helper to the treasurer, a treasurer, a recording secretary and an assistant, one of which shall be a man. In other words, this recording secretary, there must be a man among the two. We elect a man and his wife. That way the wife can assist the husband in the taking of records in the open business meetings in the total assembly. And then in the men's business meetings where the women are not present, the husband can take these things down, and between the two of them they can do the work and keep the minutes of the church up to par, and it works out very well. It's not the only way it can be done, but it seems to be a good way. Well, how about the election of officers? When are the officers to be elected? Do we just come together, you know, when we happen to feel like it and happen to think that officers need to be elected and do so? If so, how do we handle hurt feelings because an election takes place? Is that election to indicate the dissatisfaction of the church with the officers, or could we just let those officers go on until they died of old age or something of that sort? Well, there needs to be some definite in that area, just as in the case of the pastor, there needs to be a statement of when a pastor is to be called or recalled and so on. So the statement here is that the election of the officers takes place once a year. It's not to say it has to be that way, but it tells when it takes place and how they are to be elected. It talks about the committeemen or deacons and how they are to be elected and so on, and how they are to be reelected. And then, of course, there's the second section under this that talks about the trustees of the church, how long their terms are, whether or not they may be reelected. Of course, this states that they can be, but it keeps us from assuming that they can't, you see. And then, of course, it gives us the fact that one of these is to be named a secretary and a chairman. The reason that's necessary is because in the state of Oklahoma, the laws of corporation in the state of Oklahoma demand a chairman and a secretary of any corporation. So these trustees have to serve in that capacity. Now, the fourth section here deals with vacancies that are created in offices by death or by people moving away, and states that those may be filled at any time, thus protecting us from complaint of a business meeting, the election of officers, that is contrary to the basic statement here that says it's to be done once a year. It gives a provision for those cases where it needs to be done more often than that. It talks about how the Sunday school teachers and workers are to be arrived at. In other words, do we do that by letting the children vote on their Sunday school teacher? You know, I went to a church one time where the children in the church, in the class, in their own Sunday school class, decided who they wanted for a teacher. If some other choirs hadn't gotten the person, why, they got them for a teacher. And you know, when we were in the intermediate classes and on up, we pretty well elected the teacher that we felt like would let us get by with the most. And even the adults had nothing to do with it. We elected our own teacher in our own classes. It has to be the dumbest thing I ever saw. This states here that all Sunday school teachers and workers, all musicians, shall be appointed by the pastor. That may be grievous to you, but most pastors have a better knowledge of these people's qualifications, abilities, aptitudes, and so on than the church members would have. And I think wherever a church puts that amount of confidence in their pastor, it is acceptable. Some people might disagree with that, but that's what this Constitution and bylaws is for, is to declare what the church's policy is in that area, what they consider to be acceptable and not acceptable. The seventh article here deals with various committees. Now, I don't know that it's the worst thing that can happen, but I do know that many churches have been destroyed by committees. They have a committee for everything you could imagine. I heard of a church that split once, ultimately split, over whether or not they would buy round or flat toothpicks for some kind of a ladies' organization, and they just began to have harsh words in the ladies' group, and that was carried on to the husbands, and the husbands then let one thing lead to another until they had a big fight over a lot of other issues, and they finally split the church wide open, and the thing that started the problem in the first place was an argument over round or flat toothpicks. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I hope it isn't, but it would not at all surprise me that it is. So we put some in our Constitution, we put some sort of boundaries upon the committees. There shall be an advisory committee which shall consist of the pastor and at least two-thirds of the elected officers of the church. It says at least two-thirds. And many times this advisory committee here becomes a meeting of all of the men. But at least if I needed assistance in some area, I can meet with these people. And we have the Constitution of the Church behind it. When deemed necessary by the pastor, a nominating committee of five members shall be appointed by the pastor at least 30 days before the annual election. Now, I don't appoint a nominating committee here. I could do so, and it says at the option of the pastor, but we have very good harmony and always have had in our business meetings. They're carried out in a very light and yet, I think, a serious enough fashion. When I say light, I don't mean light in the sense that we don't take it seriously, but I mean light in the sense that we don't have people grappling for offices or being jealous of others who are elected to those offices. And yet I think taken seriously enough to know what's expected. And I always state that. And so we don't have to have the nominating committee. If the time ever came that there was a power struggle in the church, then I certainly would do so. And I would have the Constitution behind me. The third section states that when the need arises, a pulpit committee of five men shall be elected by the church. These shall be men of good character, spiritual discernment, and good standing in the church. I heard last week of a situation where the head of the pulpit committee in a church, and they had just made what seemed to be a terrible mistake in the calling of a pastor. The head of the pulpit committee was a man who had only been saved 5 months, if indeed he is saved at all. His profession was only 5 months old. And the reason they had elected him is that there was nobody else in church that had time to do the job. Honestly, it just seems ridiculous, but that's the way the story went. And so we have a statement here that says that there must be a pulpit committee of a competent character. And then the eighth article deals with subordinate organization, showing that the church shall have the power of general oversight and control over subordinate organizations. In other words, the ladies' fellowship can't sell the church bus and buy decorations for a shower for the pastor's wife. There is some kind of surveillance over these various organizations. The head of such organization shall submit a written report to the church and so on. And of course, this is not really talking about ladies' fellowships, but it's talking about organizations that would be considered as legitimate organizations within the church. And then it points out that the head of such an organization must be a member of the church in good standing. The subordinate organization, if they desire to use church property for any purpose, must have approval of the pastor and or officers of the church. In other words, they can't just say, well, you know, we want one of the members that can't go out and form a, as I said earlier, a softball team and go down two blocks down the street and play softball in their shorts and then come up to the church and have cake and coffee after they get through. Just isn't permitted, and we have the bylaws or the constitution of the church to see to it that it isn't. Section 5 deals with outside organizations. In other words, let's say that the treasurer's brother-in-law who goes over to the local Church of Christ but works with the treasurer decides that he would like to have a birthday party for his oldest son, and he needs a place to have it. So he goes to his brother-in-law, and he says, you know, I understand you all have a nice fellowship hall. I'd like to use that for a birthday party for my son. And the treasurer says, sure, help yourself, no problem. And the church can constantly be subjected to the use and abuse of groups like that who may bring into it cigarettes, alcohol, or anything else. If there's nothing stated as to the principles and practices. And you say, well, surely the preacher knows what's right and wrong in an area like that, or the people know, yeah, they know what's right or wrong, but it can put tremendous pressures. I suppose two or three times a year I have some group or some person calling me and asking about the use of a room, a fellowship hall, or something like that in the church for a wedding reception or something of that sort that has nothing to do with our church, people that I'm quite sure would not have the same convictions as far as dress and conduct that we would have. And this little clause has been tremendously helpful to me in that I'm simply able to say that I do not have the authority to grant them the right outside organizations to do that, because in my opinion, the article prevents me from being allowed to do so without the approval of the church organization. It just easily and very properly gets me off the hook. The sixth section of this says, all subordinate organizations shall disperse their funds with the supervision of the pastor and treasury officers of the church. In other words, we can't have a group here that sets up a subordinate organization, solicits funds, are free will offerings from the church membership at large, and then uses those as they may please. There has to be a consensus of the church and its elected officers in that area. Article 9 deals with amendments. You know, I have seen constitutions and bylaws of various things totally, not annihilated, but shackled by amendments that were tacked onto them. In fact, I saw a youth camp in the early years of my ministry actually transferred illegally from the original owners to new owners for not one dime of remuneration and without the consent of those owners by trickery in an amendment that was tacked onto it. So there needs to be something said about amendments. And the fact here it says that this constitution may be amended or revised by a two-thirds vote of the members present at any annual business meeting. You don't just jump up and amend it easily. Now then it says the bylaws appended may be amended or revised by a two-thirds vote of the members present at any given time. So we look then at the bylaws that follow this, and as I pointed out earlier, the purpose of bylaws are to govern those offices, officers, and committees that are outlined within the Constitution. In other words, the Constitution tells us what the church is made up of as far as functioning offices and officers are concerned. The bylaws govern those offices and officers. So it tells us what the duties of and the qualifications of officers are. It tells us that the qualifications are to be, according to 1 Timothy 3, what the pastor is to be like, and the sort of person that he has to be. It says here concerning the pastor that the pastor shall have charge of all spiritual welfare of the congregation. He shall act as moderator in the business meetings of the church. He shall be an ex officio member of all boards and committees, and may call any board or committee together at any time. He may call the church together for special business. He shall have the authority to purchase supplies necessary to his work. In other words, it tells what he can and can't do. Section 2. In the absence of the pastor, no meeting of the church shall be considered legal except with the pastor's approval, or when the pulpit is vacant, or when the pastor refuses deliberately to be present. And, of course, this is to protect the church from a man who said, well, you can't fire me because I'm not going to show up, and you can't have a legal meeting unless I do. Certainly, the church is not intended to be entrapped by that. Section 3, it is the duty of the committeemen and deacons to visit the sick, to prepare and distribute the elements of the Lord's Supper, to cooperate with and assist the pastor in the performance of his duties. They shall assist the pastor as he may require in all devotional services. The qualifications of the deacons and their wives are those found in 1 Timothy 3, 8-13. Section 4, the duties of the trustees. What does a trustee do? Can they just take the money and abscond with it? Well, if it didn't give some kind of qualification, in other words, as far as the bank is concerned, under the laws of the corporation in the state of Oklahoma, the trustees have total control of the money, but the law says that the trustees must be acting in the interest of those who put their business in their trust. So it says the duties of the trustees shall be to serve the church in legal matters concerning church property. They shall have no power to buy, sell, mortgage, lease, or transfer any such property without the specific vote of the church. And so you see there is a very important legal qualification that says what they can do, what they are to do, and what they cannot do. Section 5, the Board of Finance shall meet when necessary to discuss plans and ways whereby to finance the church. Of course, we have very definite ways to do that here, which is tithes and offerings, period. That's it. And to bring reports or recommendations to the church body as they deem necessary. Section 6, the clerk shall issue letters of recommendation received from sister churches and shall maintain an up-to-date file on church membership. In other words, the church clerk does not do the work here of recording secretary, even though there would be nothing wrong with it. In many churches they do. But here the office of the church clerk is to take care of the membership. That's basically what they do and nothing else. Then we have a financial secretary. He shall assist the treasurer in receiving and dispersing all contributions to the church. He shall keep a record of all contributions and pledges and issue receipts annually, etc., etc. Because we don't have the pledges. This is a copy and so on. But he shall be share co-responsibility with the treasurer in dispersing church funds. They both must co-sign the checks that go out, or at least one of the two of them, along with one other authorized man, which would be the pastor or the associate pastor in this case, who could sign the checks. It takes two of four to activate the check. Section 8, the treasurer and financial secretary shall receive for deposit all money of the church not otherwise directed. All funds shall remain at the church in a designated place until removed for deposit at the bank. All counting and dispersing of funds shall take place at the church. He shall disperse funds only as authorized by the church. A monthly financial statement shall be prepared and displayed for inspection by the church. Now, when I first started pastoring the church, the money was taken home by the treasurer at his will. The offering was taken. It was counted at his home. No one else, including the pastor, had any ability or opportunity to look at it, to know if what he said was the count was indeed the count. And you know, about 5 or 6 months after, no, it would have been a year or more after I began to pastor the church, I found that this man had borrowed a week's deposit. I found this in the records, and I only assumed that he had to have borrowed it, because he was making all of the deposits a week behind. All of them were being made 1 week behind, constantly. And I was seeing what his deposits were, and then I found that they were being made a week behind. He was taking them home, and so I called his hand in such a way as to give him an opportunity to make it up. Immediately, two deposits were made at one time. And soon thereafter, the annual business meeting came up. He said, you might want to consider somebody else for a treasurer. I'm an awful busy man. Believe you me, I did not hesitate in urging the men to nominate another man. We've had wonderful treasurers ever since. But one of the things that I instituted at that time into the minutes of the meeting of the church, and it was later instituted into these bylaws, that all of the counting of the money was to be done by two people, and it was to be done at the church. And therefore, you don't place this improper temptation upon some individual concerning that. This is taken care of in the bylaws, and I think very properly so. I must hasten for the sake of time. Section number 9 deals with the Sunday school superintendent, section 10 with the music director, section 11 the organist and pianist, section 12 the ushers and head usher, section 13 the recording secretary and assistant to such, and right on down the line. In other words, everything that we have here in the office is set forth in these bylaws so that I have a format that says this is the right way to do it, this is the wrong way to do it. And we believe that all of those ways are, as best we possibly know how, based upon a biblical format. We think that's the way it should be. Article 2 of the bylaws talks about services, and it talks about the regular meeting of the church for worship shall be as follows: Sunday school, morning worship, training union, evening worship, midweek service, and then the communion service. How often the communion service is to be held, or the fact that it can be held more frequently but not less frequently. All of that's bound up in the articles. Section 2 of Article 2 says business meetings shall be held as follows. The annual business meeting of the church shall be held at least the first convenient Wednesday night of the year. Special business meetings, not otherwise provided for, may be called by the pastor as he deems necessary. There is a format set before us where we know how these things can and cannot be done. Article 3 deals with the duties of the committees. And then Article 4 deals with the discipline committee, how the discipline committee can function, how they cannot function, the things that they have the power to do, the things they must and must not do. And so basically what we have in the Constitution and bylaws of the church is a format of conduct that we believe lays before us the biblical principle of Christian conduct within the church. Now, there are limitations of the Constitution and bylaws. They are never to conflict with the practice laid down in the Scripture. They are rather to complement it. Secondly, they are neither sufficient nor intended to operate properly without spiritual discernment. In other words, no one can take that little book and interpret it and get all the right answers and know how to conduct themselves in the house of God unless there is spiritual discernment and a Christian spirit in the hearts of the people to accompany it. Thirdly, they are not able to effect their desire and purpose if a church does not familiarize themselves with and abide by them. In other words, just having a little book laying around that says Church Members Handbook is not going to assure harmony in the administrative functions of the church if it's not abode by. But if we have it, and if we respect it, and if we use it advisedly, if we use it in a Christian fashion, I believe that a constitution for a church and bylaws to accompany that constitution can be very beneficial. These are things for your consideration. It is not an indication that you must follow after such pattern, but I hope it can be helpful to you in the area of ecclesiastical administration.